Hello, hello, a big hello and thank you to our new patrons. Thank you so much for your support, for getting on board. We look forward to chatting with you on Patreon and hearing what you think about stuff and sharing more stuff with you. Linda Gaynor, Emma Jackson, Barbara, Natalie Naidu, beautiful, Jennifer Brewer, Julia Miles, Joanna Hirsch, Sarah Jones, Meg Mathers, Samantha Worley, Andrea Dell, Andrea, oh, I just said you, Andrea, my eye just skipped up again, but hello twice, Erin E. Saulers, Melinda Pitts, Joe Pepiat, Pepiat's a fun name, Renee Murphy Spicer, Triple Bunger, Lauren Rebecca, Callie Robertson, Kale, or is that Cal? It's so tiny. Is it C-A-I-L or C-A-L-L? Either way, you know who you are. You've only got one name. There's a clue. Samantha Pena and, or Penna. I mean, Pena's more fun, obviously. But if you're going with Penna, that's cool. And Damon Nelvring. Hello, everybody. Thank you.
Just wanted to give a shout out to Maya from the post office who listens to our podcast. And thanks for the great customer service, Maya. It was very nice to meet you and know that you listen to our podcast.
Please be advised this podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence and it's not appropriate for children.
This is Australian True Crime with Emily Webb and guest co-host, crime writer Vicky Petratis. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next. 30 years ago, journalist Megan Norris followed the trial closely of Tracy Wigginton, who was dubbed the vampire killer and one of Australia's worst female murderers. In 1989, in Brisbane in Queensland, Tracy Wigginton killed father of four and grandfather, Edward Baldock. And so take us back, because I do recall seeing the headlines, and it's always been a case that I think people have remembered, and also we've had a lot of listeners request for us to do something on this. So set the scene for us and how you became involved in reporting on this case.
Well, this case was in the courts when I just arrived from England. So I'd just come out from the UK with my family. We just emigrated. And it was all over the news. The case had actually gone to trial. So it happened in 1989. And the trial had gone to court in the following year. So I'd arrived in 1990. And this was one of the first cases that was all over the papers. And yet there was little detail given. And I remember being very intrigued with Tracy Wigginton's case because there was little detail given. It was a very salacious, gory, awful case. It had got all the elements of a late night horror movie, I thought, and yet there was little detail given. She pleaded guilty to murdering this guy, and as a result, it was a sort of brief plea hearing where they outlined the various facts, and she was sentenced to life. I think the sentencing hearing lasted about 9 minutes, which for a case of that magnitude and the horror was, as a court reporter, I just thought, why is this so flimsy? But what happened was she didn't do this on her own. I think that's what made the case so interesting. Women rarely kill. When they do, they kill their husbands and kids, their partners and kids. They rarely go off and kill a complete stranger. And they rarely do it in a gang, in a pack. And Tracy Wigginton's, this murder happened in a pack. So what happened was in 89, on 21st of October, which Satanists believe is the actual true Halloween, not the 31st of October, Tracy Wigginton was a Satanist. And she went off with a group of girlfriends. That's what made the case eventually make the headlines. She was in a lesbian relationship with her lover, Lisa Paczynski. And there were two other young women part of this group, and they were also in a relationship. But apparently she had some strange hypnotic hold over the whole group. Their defense later portrayed a very passive role. But they went out hunting, and this was on the night of the 21st of October, the true Halloween. They went out hunting for someone to kill so that Tracy Wigginton could satisfy her need to feed. I think they used that word in the case, the need to feed. In actual fact, she was a vampire. She was a self-professed vampire who went shopping for things like pig's blood and cow's blood and claimed that she lived only on cow and pig blood and didn't go out during the day and was very pale because she sort of hunted at night, as you'd expect vampires would. This was the story. So she goes off on the trawl in her green Commodore with Prince's Bat Dance blazing in the background on the radio with these girlfriends looking for someone to murder. And they'd hatched this chilling plan beforehand to drive around and find someone that she could murder so she could satisfy her bloodlust, kill him and drink his blood. That was the plan. So off they go, and they're trawling the streets around West End in Brisbane, and they spot this poor guy, Edward Baldock, who was clinging to a lamppost after a boozy night out at some Scottish club in Kangaroo Point. And she gets out of the car, she calls him over and lures him into the car on the promise of sex. So he gets in the car and she drives down to Orley Park, which was in the inner city on the West End. And this guy was so drunk, I think he was six times over the limit. He took his clothes off and he stripped on the banks of the river and he folded all his clothes really neatly. And he spotted on the grass, and as drunk as he was, he spotted an ATM card. He may have thought it was his own, but he may have also thought it belonged to one of the group. He slipped the card into his shoe. Anyway, she got him to take his clothes off. She's 17 stone. She was a big girl. And she launched into this tiny little man with a large knife. 27 times she stabbed him. She almost severed his head in the attack. And apparently, after the attack, she disappeared down to the river where she washed the knife and washed her hands, having sat smoking a cigarette while she watched him die. One of the wounds that she created was as big as a small bread and butter plate. So it was a pretty vicious attack. And apparently she turned up back at the car where the three other girls sat in the car and watched. That was the story. And they said she smelled of blood on her mouth and that she had blood around her mouth. And she appeared as sated as someone who'd just eaten a three-course meal.
How did all this detail come out? Was it the witnesses? Was it Tracy herself?
Yes. What happened was, and I followed that case quite closely, the plea hearing of Tracy Wigginton was a done deal. You know, she admitted it, and it spared the victim's family the horror of a trial. You know, so they would have gone through every bit of evidence and all this would have come out. But it didn't come out at the time in Tracy's plea hearing. She just pleaded guilty. It was a brief description of what she'd done. She'd stabbed the guy to death, apparently to drink his blood. They didn't go into the detail. But what happened was the three cohorts pleaded not guilty to his murder. So the following year, there was a trial where they, interestingly, didn't give any evidence at all on their own behalf. They didn't take the stand. But the prosecution painted this very, very gory picture of what had happened on that night. They were very careful to play down the role of the three co-defendants. They had passive roles. They sat in the car. They didn't believe she was going to do what she did. That was the sort of line. They were just really under her strange hypnotic spell. That was the take. But all the information came out. And you can imagine the following year when this went to trial and they had three young women in the dock. And it was a very salacious case for the prosecution, who painted it like a late night horror movie. The actual detail of what she did to the victim remained in the court files. She actually made a confession after her arrest, because the bank card immediately led to her arrest. They left the scene and they left not realizing the bank card was in the shoe. And it was Tracy Wigginton's Commonwealth bank card. Talk about a blunder. So that bank card had been slipped in the victim's shoe. So while she'd sat and watched him die, she was unaware that she dropped her bank card. And of course, when the police were called to the scene, it was one of the first things they found. So they were all under arrest. Tracy and her co-defendants were under arrest by the following day. But she had made several trips back to the crime scene, apparently to look for that bank card. And when the police confronted her with the discovery of the bank card, she claimed she'd been in the park the day before with her friends playing on some swings. It was a very unlikely story. And then when she was told that her co-defendants had already confessed and blamed her, she said, turn the tape on. And it was a real life interview with a vampire. Basically, she told every gritty detail of what she'd done. But that was never played at her plea hearing, because she pleaded guilty. And it was never played at the trial of the three co-defendants who pleaded not guilty. So this was sort of locked away in police archives for many years. When she was given parole in 2012, that detail managed to find its way into the local press, because it was a very controversial subject, her release. I didn't actually go to the court case, because I'd just arrived from England. I was in Melbourne. I was following it in the press and wondering where all the detail was, that whole thing. But, you know, I've looked at photos of her. I've read the reporting of the interview. When you marry that up with the defendant who's charged with this, and you realize she was 23 years old. She was a very young woman to have done such a thing. She was portrayed as a monster in the media. And I was very interested when I was working on that case, writing about it years later, was what had happened to her. You know, what makes a 23-year-old young woman commit such a frenzied, awful crime? Tracy Wigginson had the most dreadful, dreadful background. And she'd been assessed by a team of doctors to determine whether or not she was actually mentally fit to stand trial, you know, whether she was actually mentally fit to enter a plea at all. An order was made under the Queensland Mental Health Review Tribunal to appoint a team of prominent forensic psychiatrists and psychologists to interview Wigginson. And they actually performed 26 hours of intensive hypnotherapy to make that determination. And none of that information was released at the time either.
Has it been released now?
Well, snatches of it. Things have been released since into the general media and interviews with her family too. It was known that she had the most appalling, horrific upbringing. She was a sort of true test case for multiple personalities.
And are we thinking sort of physical abuse or sexual abuse? Because often
She was brought up by grandparents. Her mother had given birth to her very young and moved back into her adoptive parents' home. I think her mother was adopted. And she'd moved back into her adoptive parents' home where Tracy was brought up by the adoptive grandparents. They were people of considerable wealth. They were upstanding pillars of the community to the outside world. Behind closed doors of their home in Rockhampton, it was a nightmare for the young Tracy Wigginson. You know, so to the outside world, granddaughter of their adopted daughter, she had everything, the best education, elocution lessons, music lessons. They bought her a $5,000 organ to play on, and she apparently was very talented. But her adoptive grandfather was a sexually depraved man, and his wife was a man-hater. She was a sadist, and her influence on little Tracy's life basically shaped her fate.
It's never without a price, is it? You know, those upbringings, you don't come out of it unscathed.
Well, you don't. She was 9 years old, and this George Wigginson began abusing her then. And she suffered horrific torment, sickening sexual abuse, but she was more afraid of her grandmother. And her grandmother was called Avril. And she was just sadistic and violent, clearly very ill. Apparently, she would flog the little girl with the electrical cord from an iron while screeching that all men were dirty bastards. And she would beat and beat the little girl while doing this. And so she grew up very damaged, obviously.
The co-defendants or the other girls that were with Tracy that night, did they get any jail time or what happened to those women?
Yes, they were all jailed as well for lesser sentences. They were all jailed. Tracy got life in Queensland. It was an automatic life sentence. So she got life. The others got far lesser sentences. Certainly, they believed the Wiggingtons were ritual Satanists. And they believed that Tracy Wigginson was exposed and abused by Satanists. One of the treating psychiatrists later spoke about it. His name was Dr. Jim Quinn, and he was the head of behavioural medicine at a hospital in New South Wales, and he was enlisted by the Queensland Public Defender's Office to examine Tracy Wigginson. And he said after her sentencing that he was convinced that black magic, not vampirism, had been the real motive for the murder of Edward Baldock, that she may not have been looking for blood on the night she killed, not because she wanted to drink it. She was looking for blood, but not because she wanted to drink it. She wanted to spill it. It was a Satanist killing. That's what he believed. He determined that she'd got these multiple personalities. His theory was a combination of personalities were involved in the killing that night. It was more of a human sacrifice. It was like the ultimate satanic ritual. And he explained that he hypnotized Tracy Wigginson. And he said that an evil, terrifying alter ego had emerged. And the personality was one she referred to as Avril. Now, that's the name of her grandmother. So it's almost certainly this very evil persona that emerged and actually committed the killing. It was Avril. It was her grandmother she had become. That was the theory. And that it was one of the lesser personalities, the little young Tracy, who slipped the card in the shoe to get her caught. It's quite complex, isn't it?
Yeah.
But they're saying that Avril was the sort of deranged, crazy, bloodthirsty personality that had murdered Edward Baldock. She had many personalities, but the young Tracy was the person who wanted Avril stopping and had slipped that card in her shoe.
Was Tracy's adopted grandparents still alive when this murder occurred?
No, they were not. But under hypnosis, Wigginton gave a very graphic account of a blood sacrifice that had taken place on a mountain very close to her home in Rockhampton, and it involved a slaughtering a goat. And under hypnosis, she claimed that those involved in the ritual slaughter had consumed the blood of the slaughtered animal. And when police went to the site on Mount Archer, where under hypnosis Tracy Wigginton had revealed this information, they actually confirmed the story by finding bloodstains on the rock that she had described had been used for the ritual slaughter.
No wonder this story was so widely publicised. If this happened today, would there be as much luridness about it?
Yes, I think it would have had. At the time she went to plea, you know, it was all considered to be so dreadful. The argument was they were sparing the victim's family, which they probably were.
Yeah.
You know, but because it was a plea, she just pleaded guilty. They outlined the bare bones of the case and she was jailed for life. When the trial of the three co-defendants reached the court, well, it did read like a late night movie script, a horror movie script. So they did certainly focus on the fact that Tracy Wigginton was a vampire. They were really focused very much more on the vampire aspect of it rather than the Satanist aspect of it, because that had come out in the hypnotherapy sessions, which were not revealed. As far as media were concerned and the prosecution, it was a vampire murder. And they were much more interested in this strange hypnotic spell that she'd cast over these three poor, influenced, young, weak young women who were just followers. They were much more interested in the dynamic of the lesbian relationships between them than they were in the actual murder. And the coverage was very preoccupied with that. So all of this stuff didn't come out. I think if that happened today, people would be digging. I think we're a bit more desensitized, don't you?
Yeah.
I think there would have been a lot more coverage. And actually, Tracy Wigginton, when she was finally released, there were about 30-odd conditions attached to her parole. And so she's never been able to talk about it. But the detective in the case, Pat Glancy, who, interestingly, Pat Glancy is now retired and lives on the Gold Coast, where Tracy Wigginton now lives. Isn't that interesting?
It's a funny meeting at Coles, isn't it?
You know,
if you bump
into
him. You
know, where he brought her to justice and he saw the crime scene. He sat in on that interview. He had no doubt the way she described it was very lacking in any passion or any empathy. It was very cold. It was very chilling. And she just described, you know, oh, you know, I got the knife out and I stabbed him in the neck and I wanted to get to the bone and he was twitching and all the nerves were twitching, but I needed to get to the bone. Now, the prosecution made a lot of the actual killing in the trial of the three co-defendants, but their take on it was that she needed to cause great damage so she could drink his blood. That was not what Dr. Quinn thought. He didn't think that was the motive for murder at all. He thought the unconscious motive for the murder was to spill blood, not to drink it.
What did they think then? Spill blood, drink blood, what's the difference in terms of the meaning behind that, do you think?
Well, he said it was an unconscious motive for the murder because it was actually, it harked back to her terrible childhood and he believed she had been exposed to satanic ritual killings. And so she was sort of subconsciously acting out what she'd seen her grandmother do. You know, her grandmother was quite crazy and sadistic and into all this satanic stuff. And he believed her willingness to plead guilty to the murder was to avoid a very widely publicised trial where the satanic aspect of the crime would have become public, because that sort of witchcraft, you know, the videotaped evidence of the hypnotherapy sessions, which were suggesting witchcraft, would have definitely become on the part of the public record. And that would have allowed the co-accused to portray her in an even more evil way, you know? So she basically took the rap and said, it was me, it was only me. I take all responsibility. Just send me to jail.
Do we know if there was any manifestations of this Satanism, of vampirism in prison? Was she a perfectly behaved prisoner?
Yeah, well, they called her Drac in prison and they claimed that she was wanting to eat raw meat and all this sort of thing. So they did call her Drac in prison. You know, when you look at the context of her upbringing, that satanic, imagine that little girl being sexually abused from a very young age, you know, seriously abused. And imagine her being exposed to the sort of things that she saw. you know, well, where did all that go? It was buried there somewhere in her head, wasn't it?
Do you think she was scared as well about the satanic stuff she'd experienced and that coming out in the trial because of, I don't know, people who were around who were into that or who knew her or...
I think that's very likely. Imagine the fear that would live with you forever. There may have been people that were still around from that scene. If you think of it differently, you know, she was a very abused and damaged young woman, 23, to go off and commit a murder of that nature.
If you're enjoying this episode with Megan, you might want to listen to episode number 3 about the story of Robert Farquharson, who on Father's Day 2005 drove his car into a dam, killing his 3 children. After the break, Megan Norris details the victim's family's concerns about the killer's release. Coming up, Megan tells us more about Tracy Wigington's other alter egos.
I think they determined she had about 6 different personalities. They did diagnose her with multiple personality disorder, she was. And Dr. Quinn believed that a coalition of personalities had acted in concert on that night. Not Tracy with her co-defendants, but a coalition of the personalities that lived in her head may have acted in concert on that night. And that one of them remained fearful or believed she deserved to be punished. And if you think about it, the man she murdered so hideously was a middle-aged, balding man with a pot belly and was very much the grandfather figure that had abused her. What the psychiatrist believed was that she was actually acting out this horrific murder on the grandfather who'd abused her. And if you think about it, that makes a whole lot more sense than going off to find someone whose blood you wanted to drink. So I'm not sure she was a vampire at all.
I keep thinking as we're speaking about the victim, Edward Baldock, and horrific, horrific way to die. And I think in this case, because of the luridness of it and the shock value, he kind of got, I guess, forgotten a bit. And I just wonder, how did his family cope with that? You know, Tracy said that she lured him under the pretext of having sex. He was very drunk. You know, that would have been very hurtful for the family, but also just, I guess, her actions overtook what we know about him. So did you ever know much about his family or did they speak?
No one spoke to me, but I looked into the family background and they were absolutely devastated. Take the killing aside, the actual killing was graphic and awful, but that he was forgotten. He became the deceased. You know, that's what happens, isn't it, when it goes to court, that becomes the deceased. But I think what had happened was that inside prison, she made several parole bids. When she made her parole bid, she was actually supported by solicitor Debbie Kilroy, the director of Sisters Inside, prisoners advocacy group. They'd first met inside Bugger Road Jail, Brisbane, where Wigington was serving life. And Kilroy was serving a 6-year jail sentence for drug offences. And after being released from prison, she established Sisters Inside, a support campaign group for female prisoners. And over the years that followed, she revealed she'd had many conversations with Wigington and said that this notorious prisoner, this vampire murderer, you know, that was portrayed in the press, had always expressed remorse for her crime. Wigington had always said she hated the lesbian vampire killer tag that the media had given her. And that as far as Kilroy was concerned, Wigington was a transformed woman. And that she'd expressed true remorse. She'd even written to her victim's family and said not a day went by, not a day in all of that time she spent in prison, not a day went by where she didn't think about what she'd done. And she had to live with that. So, you know, you do wonder, don't you? But there was certainly a lot of opposition to her parole bid from the victim's family. And I think the victim's niece, Tanya Jackson, she gave an interview to the Courier Mail in December before the release of Tracy Wigington in 2012. And she said, you know, for my uncle and for my family, it's a life sentence. We live with it every day. You know, Tracy Wigington took someone's life and the family didn't believe she ever deserved her place back in society. And even Wigington's own family expressed concerns over her release. It wasn't just the victim's family. Wigington's own family expressed concern. Her half-sister, Ali Hopkins, said she remained very afraid of Tracy, who she still believed to be very dangerous. She actually described a lot of childhood cruelty that she'd witnessed. Tracy was very cruel. She was very cruel. She tortured animals. You know, she'd got all the makings of a serial killer.
Sounds like, well, a very damaged woman who went on to do damage, which we hear all the time. This is how it plays out. One thing I'm just trying to get clear is, so her grandparents, were they like her blood relatives, so to speak? Or
no.
So how did they end up adopting her?
Well, they had adopted her mother, Rhonda.
Right.
They were upstanding members of the community in Rockhampton, very well known, very well off, affluent, philanthropic to the outside world. And they'd adopted Rhonda. Well, Rhonda went off and married some other bloke and didn't really have a lot of time for Tracy. But I think that Rhonda had a very young, the relationship didn't work. She went back to her adopted family to live, and little Tracy went with her. And she left Tracy with them when she went off to marry someone else.
Do we know who Tracy's father was?
No, we don't appear to know who he was.
Has Rhonda ever spoken in the aftermath of the crime or over the years?
Yes, she did. And she told reporters from one Queensland newspaper that she didn't believe her daughter was a vampire. She claimed that Tracy was so squeamish that even the sight of blood made her sick. There's a story that she couldn't even watch her family killing chickens. She couldn't even deal with a sick chook because of the blood. And someone had told Tracy, chop its head off and put the poor creature out of its misery. But she couldn't do it. She couldn't stand the sight of blood. That's what her mother said. I think Aunt Doral gave an interview in the aftermath of Tracy's jailing, and she insisted Tracy was not a vampire. But she actually said Tracy was taking revenge for a stolen childhood. So she was acknowledging the horrors of Tracy's childhood.
Did Tracy get, you know, over the years in jail, she would have got some counselling, some, well, rehabilitation?
Yes. And they said that through extensive and gruelling hypnotherapy, they found she was suffering from this rare, extreme dissociative. It wasn't just multiple personality disorder. It was a rare, extreme form of dissociative multiple personality disorder. We all know dissociation is believed to occur as a result of trauma. And if you imagine that these allegations of particularly prolonged ritual sexual abuse or incest, Tracy's mind would have fragmented into different identities in a way to protect her. And effectively, her mind is closing down to blot out the traumatic events that she'd witnessed. And by forgetting those burying those painful events, it's thought that multiple personality disorder alters other facets of a person's personality. And that enables other personas to step in and take over. And that was a unanimous agreement that the doctors reached. They did 2 weeks of psychiatric assessment that was ordered by the Queensland Mental Health Review Tribunal. And they determined that she most certainly suffered from multiple personality disorder.
And that wasn't taken into account, was it, Megan, in her sentencing?
No.
So how long did she end up serving all up?
I think it would have been around 19 years. Well, she was jailed in 1990 and she was released in 2012, 22 years.
Because it was big news when she got released, I remember.
Oh, they sneaked her out of prison. The media were there trying to get a photo. And interestingly, she came out on crutches, a shadow of herself. You know, she hobbled out on crutches. She'd got hepatitis C, and was very, very ill. She's a frail, ill, disabled woman when she came out. She was not the young 17-stone, strong woman that went in, but that was just a part of her persona. Inside Tracy's head were all these different people.
Is the danger diffused? You know, is she still dangerous? Because I saw that photo and she did look sort of vulnerable and weak, but do you think she's still dangerous?
I don't have the answer to that, though. I believe people can be rehabilitated. But if you've got multiple personality disorder, is there a cure for that? I don't know that there's a cure for that. And certainly the policeman that Pat Glancy, the detective who'd interviewed Tracy and been privy to the details of the crime, he believed she remained very dangerous. He said he would be sleeping with one eye open. He thought she remained extremely dangerous. The family believes she remained dangerous. But it was determined by granting her parole that she was safely able to go back into society.
And she'd be getting plenty of support, you'd assume, to be able to live. If she is living with a disability as well, she would certainly need certain support.
Well, she would. And you do wonder, though, what happened with her interest in black magic. She had an obsessive interest in black magic. Everyone described that. Her sister, Michelle, described that she'd had an obsessive interest growing up with the occult. They'd held seances, they flirted with black magic. But when Tracy's talk turned to animal sacrifice, it lost all appeal for her sister Michelle. But it continued to fuel Tracy's disturbed imagination. As a teenager, she sought out friends in a gothic subculture, where according to one of her friends, the group she belonged to spent their spare time lurking around local cemeteries and holding midnight feasts and things. you know, eating raw meat and all sorts. And, you know, I wonder where her interest in, you know, satanic ritual went.
It seems like a very teenagerish thing to do, that sort of dabbling in Ouija boards. And it was sort of its time. I seem to remember growing up in the 80s and 90s, there did seem to be a little bit of a fixation on black magic. There was a few films that came out of that effect.
There was. Yeah. I agree, but they didn't have Tracy's background.
No, that's right. It's not just private schoolgirls, you know, having a bit of a laugh at a slumber party.
I know that during the mental health review, which, you know, they did all this hypnotherapy, but she was having violent headaches after her arrest, violent headaches. And because of the violent headaches, that was why she agreed to undergo hypnotherapy. They didn't know why she was having these violent headaches. And these are seasoned mental health forensic psychiatrists. They were shocked at what they saw during those videotape sessions. You know, they would watch her shrieking and sweating and trembling and these different voices coming in, and watched her face and her body contorting in pain as they were delving into her mind to unravel the truth behind the murder. You know, you imagine that. There had been a trial, all of that would come out. Clearly, she didn't want it to. But they said her tortured mind had splintered into five completely separate personalities, each with different memories and different roles. So each of those personalities played a role on that fateful night in October, each of them. So they think that Avril was the one that did the killing. And one of them was called Bobby. And Bobby was a personality that had emerged in childhood at the time she was being abused. And Bobby was an avenger and protector of the little Tracy.
And perhaps male, because the grandfather targeted female.
Yes, and actually it was Bobby that put the knife in. Tracy said it was Bobby that put the knife in.
It's almost horrible sense, doesn't it?
It's complicated, isn't it? But, you know, there was little Tracy, the personality little Tracy, that represented the little girl who was being abused in her childhood. Then there was the observer, and the observer appeared during hypnotherapy and monitored the behaviour and thoughts of all the others, but like almost like a narrator, narrating to the psychiatrist what the others were all up to. And she referred to it as the observer. And the fifth personality was Avril. Avril was a shrieking, frightening, evil, wicked stepmother type. So obviously Avril was the brutal grandmother that the doctors were really interested in.
It's very hard, I think, sometimes for people to get their head around that women can be as sadistic and violent and abusive as men. I always think of the case of Fred and Rose West.
Yes.
By all accounts, Rose was kind of driving everything, you know, and as sadistic or more sadistic than Fred was. I mean, Fred was awfully abusive as well. But yeah, I think that was really shocking when you read about that case. And I think with stereotypes, gender stereotypes, it kind of doesn't marry up in your mind that this could be the case.
But if you look at Tracy Wigginton and you understand the role the multiple personalities played, and you accept what her alter egos told the doctors during hypnotherapy, it was a male that killed Edward Baldock. And actually, Bobby, the persona, the alter ego, was killing George, her grandfather. It was a male type of sadistic killing, even though Tracy had the knife in her hand. She was killing her grandfather. That was what she was doing in her warped mind. That's what she was doing. I found the whole thing totally, totally fascinating. But imagine the upbringing that that young woman had had at 23 to do that kind of thing. And it was alter ego Big Tracy, who was so distraught watching Bobby, or rather Tracy, killing the victim. She wanted Bobby to be stopped.
Fascinating. And this is probably one of Australia's cases that people will remember, isn't it? And it'll always be in the headlines at some point or another.
I think it will. And I know recently there was a lot of complaining going around. I think she may have been on a social networking site, but her parole conditions are so strict that she can't even do that. Ironically, isn't it, the whole vampire tag that she attracted? The vampire thing is to drink blood to be immortal, to be remembered forever. And she sort of has, hasn't she?
When you think about female Australian killers, you think of Tracy, you think of Catherine Knight, you think of Catherine Burney, those kind of people.
Does the rarity, Megan, do you think, of these female offenders, does that affect sentencing? Because it seems like women get these much longer sentences than certainly other people that I've researched. We would love to see male offenders getting those similar long sentences.
I think it depends. depends. I don't necessarily agree with that because I think it depends on the nature of the crime. When women commit truly horrific crimes like this one, I actually think juries and courts in general are more likely to view women. A good defence will often attract a lesser sentence for women where it wouldn't for men. I actually think that. And I've talked to a few sort of feminist criminologists about that who say certainly for women who kill their family, women who kill their children, we don't want to think of women being capable of killing their own, a mother killing their own child. They must be sick to kill their own children. We don't think that women would kill their own children because they just don't want them. You know, they're in the way. Like, no one wants to think of that. It goes against nature sort of thing. But we know that women do, and they murder for all the same reasons as men do. Revenge, anger. I don't think that necessarily they do, but when they're random murders like this and they're truly, truly horrific, well, yes, I do think they get very long sentences. And I think that it was an automatic jail sentence up here in Queensland.
Right. She got parole before her sentence was up.
Yeah.
So how long do those parole conditions last? Do they last until, to say she got a 30-year sentence and she got out after 22? Does she only have to remain silent for the 8 years?
I'm pretty sure that her parole was extremely strict and it went for a very long time. But you've got to bear in mind, she came out, she was 125 kilo. She's immobile due to knee and back injury. She's had constant surgery and hepatitis C. So her 31 parole conditions barred her from ever speaking to other journalists, ever selling her story, ever profiting in any way at all from her crime. Her conditions prohibited her from contacting her co-offenders, from making contact with the victim's family. So even if she wanted to apologise all these years later, now she can't. They prohibit her from taking drugs or alcohol or even entering a pub.
Wow.
But they said that her health, her deteriorating health and her disability meant she posed a very low risk of reoffending and therefore did not require electronic monitoring.
So the social media thing that came up, did she violate her parole by going on social
media? Well,
there
was an argument that she was not supposed to be on social media.
Right.
There was a public post on Facebook. She posted images containing images of vampire skeletons and real human remains, apparently.
Oh, that's weird.
It's not a wise move, is it?
And that was in February. She had posted disturbing images, which is what I was saying before. You know, you have to wonder where that preoccupation with the occult, with human remains, with vampires, where'd it go?
She's probably got a lot of time on her hands, and if she's unable to work or get around because of her physical, you know, issues, well, what are you going to do? You sort of sit and stew, don't you? Or spend a lot of time online.
Exactly. And she's put, and when you look at what she posted a skull and crossbones and it says in grim, grisly, chilling letters, "Now panic because I'm back."
The victim's family would be justifiably horrified with that, wouldn't they? Because even if she did write to them and say how sorry she was, for her to do that when she's out is kind of showing a bit of a disregard, isn't it?
Isn't it? And she's still saying the same things, you know, that there's still a preoccupation there, images and references to people being eaten. So it's still concerning, isn't it?
Yeah. And so do you think her parole officers are looking at that really closely and getting worried?
I would say that she would still be being closely monitored, even though they didn't determine that she needed to wear an electronic bracelet or anything like that. She's not so disabled that she's not posting and thinking those thoughts, you know. And I think, well, I guess it's not an offence to think those thoughts. But when you're on parole for the kind of crime that she's committed, you'd have to wonder if she was ready for parole.
It shows at least a real insensitivity to the whole story, doesn't it?
The words of Debbie Kilroy really sort of affected me because she said she is a really sad woman. She is a sad, damaged woman. She has a background, like a lot of women in prison, that's complex and full of trauma, and the trauma that's been inflicted on her. And in many ways, she is very, very sad. But that was while she was locked up, and now she's not.